Great, thanks. Thanks all to all of you for being here. So as Ignacio said, this is a presentation about facility location models, and I'm planning to just give you a pretty high-level overview of what's done in facility location modeling and kind of where the boundaries of the field are, and not really provide too much detail about anything, but of course if you have particular questions about some of the topics, I'm happy to talk in more detail if it's something I know about. So let's go to slide two. By the way, the slide numbers are right between the title and the body of the slide, so they're a little bit hidden there, but so I'm on slide two now, the outline slide. So in this talk, I'm going to give you an introduction first about what facility location models are. Then I'll talk about a kind of taxonomy, I mean, different ways of classifying location models. I'll present the IP formulations for a couple of the classical models, talk a little about the algorithmic approaches that have been used to solve them. And then I'll talk about several different extensions that have emerged, some a long time ago and some quite recently. And finally, I'll summarize by discussing a little bit what I know about the commercial implementations of these kinds of models and the capabilities and things that they can't really do. Okay, so slide four. Facility location models are basically trying to decide where to locate facilities, and facility is a very general term. It could mean factory, warehouse, distribution center, and so on, or things that don't even really look or feel like facilities, and I'll give you examples of those in a second. And the idea is to serve customers in order to achieve some balance between cost and service. So in the picture here, the squares are the facilities, and they're serving customers that are located across the U.S., and, you know, of course, we could open lots and lots of facilities and have great service because all the customers would have very short lead times from the facility that serves them. But, of course, that would be very high cost. And then, of course, if we open very few facilities, then we have the opposite. So there's a trade-off there. And in one way or another, almost every facility location model is trying to approach that trade-off. But the flavor of how they do it is very, very different from model to model. Slide five. Usually, these location models have two decisions to make, where to locate and which customers are assigned, or sometimes we use the term allocated, to which facility. So in other words, where should the squares be located in the picture on the previous slide, and where should the lines be drawn? And sometimes because of this dual decision structure, these models are referred to as location allocation models. Not all location models have an explicit allocation component, but many do, and so it's worth being aware of that that term. Slide six lists a handful of applications for facility location models that have been reported in the literature. You can see it's all kinds of locations for facilities, both in the private sector and the public sector. Public sector locations like ambulance and fire station locations, blood banks, and so on, and private sector like fast food restaurants and I guess many of these actually are public sector. But you can imagine there are lots and lots of private sector applications, too. And because most of those applications don't get reported in the literature, you know, most of them haven't made it to my slide. But, you know, these are applied widely and in all sorts of areas. And if you go to the next slide, there's a list of what I'll call virtual facility applications. These don't really feel like facilities, but facility location models have been applied to them. So, for example, there's actually quite a big body of literature on using facility location models to locate wildlife reserves so that, for example, birds don't have to fly more than a certain distance in order to go from one reserve to another. So you're not really locating facilities, but you are making explicit decisions about some geographical issue. At the bottom of the list, the things like political party platforms and product positioning is even more virtual. The idea there is you have some, let's say, space of user preferences or voter preferences or consumer preferences, and you're trying to locate your party's platform or your candidate's platform or your product's features in that space in order to kind of capture as many of the voters or consumers as possible. Those types of applications are a little bit more abstract, and I don't know that political parties are really using those directly, but there are some interesting papers that kind of look at that that application anyway. And finally, facility location models are also important because they sometimes arise as sub-problems for other OR problems. So the main example here is vehicle routing. There are certain sorts of relaxations and decompositions where the sub-problem becomes a facility location problem, so we have to be able to solve that efficiently. Okay, now I'm on slide nine, and this is the section on the taxonomy of location models. I'll just discuss several ways that location models are classified. Probably the first and most important way is what I'll call topology. There are mainly three types of location models: continuous, discrete, and network models. In the continuous models, you can locate a facility anywhere you want on the plane. So I drew those squares representing the facilities, and then I moved that square on the right a tiny little bit just to indicate that if we want to move that a little bit, we can. In contrast, those models tend to be very nonlinear because you're computing like a Euclidean distance between these points, and so continuous and nonlinear optimization techniques are used. The most famous example there is the Weber problem, which involves locating a single facility, and then there are many extensions from there. Discrete location models, in contrast, assume that there's a discrete set of points that is fixed and given, and we're only allowed to locate facilities at those points. So the dark orange squares are where we chose to locate points, facilities, and then the light orange squares are the ones where we could have located facilities, but we didn't. And notice that some of those squares are co-located with customers. In general, sometimes that's the case, sometimes it's not. It doesn't really matter from a modeling perspective whether the facilities and customers are in the same locations or not. And generally, these become linear integer programming problems, and that's the main methodology that's applied, and I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Then the third category is network models, and here the idea is that we can there's a network of nodes and arcs, and we're allowed to locate, and the nodes are the customers, and we're allowed to locate facilities anywhere on the network, both at the nodes and on the arcs. Now, and when we locate a facility, we have to travel along the arcs in order to get from the facility to the customer. So you can see, for example, that the facility on the left has to travel two arcs to get to that customer on the bottom, but only one arc to get to the other customers. In contrast, in the discrete case, we assume we can just sort of travel in some straight line to get from the facility to the customer, but we can also assume in the discrete case that those distances are just given explicitly. They may or may not follow any particular pattern, and therefore the discrete case is more general. The network case is actually a special case, assuming that we only locate at the nodes of the network. And it turns out that there's a very famous property called the Hakimi property, which says that it's optimal always to locate at the nodes. We can ignore the arcs, which makes it a discrete problem instead of a continuous problem. The Hakimi property holds for some problems, but not all. Although when it doesn't hold, there tends to be a way of creating discrete dummy points, a finite number of discrete dummy points along the arcs at which there's an optimal solution that locates there. So in general, there are usually ways of converting that continuous type problem into a discrete type problem, which gets rid of a lot of the nonlinearities and lets us use IP techniques to solve them. At any rate, I'll consider discrete problems, but since network problems are essentially a special case, much of what I talk about will apply to network problems as well. And discrete problems are, I would say, the most commonly studied in the literature and also the most commonly applied in practice. Slide 10. There are lots of ways to measure distance in a facility location problem. You can imagine that these points are located on a plane and you're just calculating a Euclidean distance. Another common metric is the so-called rectilinear or Manhattan metric or L1 norm. And basically there the idea is that you have to travel only north, south, or east-west. In other words, you can only travel along perpendicular lines, as though you're traveling along a street, along streets in a city like Manhattan. And so there you can't go diagonally across one corner to another. You have to go north or south and then east or west. Now, neither of those metrics accounts for the fact that the Earth is curved, and when you're traveling along a reasonably large distance, that becomes a non-trivial effect. So these great circle distances account for the curvature of the Earth. Essentially, they assume that you're traveling over a great circle across the Earth and account for the, you know, at least approximately for the curvature. Highway or network distances basically assume that you're traveling along a network, like the highway network, and that you're solving a shortest path problem to get from one point to another. And then the most general type of metric is just a matrix. You just tell me from every facility to every customer what's the distance. I don't care which metric those came from. Maybe they didn't come from any metric. They could come from air travel fares, in which case the triangle inequality doesn't hold. They could look totally crazy, but you give me that matrix and I can solve the facility location problem. And since that's the most general and, the, and in some ways the simplest, I'll just assume that all of those costs are given by some matrix, and we don't really care at this point where they came from. And I also just want to mention that distance and transportation costs, to me, are essentially the same. I'll use those two terms interchangeably. So in other words, you might give me a matrix of distances, and I might multiply it by a per mile rate in order to get the transportation cost, but they differ only by a scalar, so I'll just use them interchangeably. Slide 11. Almost every facility location problem involves some objective or constraint that measures distance in some way. And there are two main flavors to that. One measures the total distance, and one measures the maximum distance. This third one here, coverage, is sort of a special case of the second. I'll talk about that in a second. So the total distance is measuring the sum across all the customers of the distance from that customer to the facility that it got assigned or allocated to. Usually there's also a demand term multiplied by the distance inside the sum, so that I'm measuring not just the distance, but also the demand of that customer, so that it costs me 10 times as much to serve a customer that has 10 times as much demand, assuming the distances are equal. And again, there, the most natural interpretation is transportation cost. You imagine that the distance is 100 miles. I pay $1 a mile per pound, let's say. And so it's a function both of the distance and of the weight or some other measure of the demand. The second case is the maximum distance. There are models that either constrain or optimize the maximum distance between a customer and its assigned facility, usually an unweighted distance in this case. So we take a max over all customers of the distance from the customer to the assigned facility. These tend to get used a little more in public sector problems where, for example, we want to make sure that we locate facilities in an equitable way so that even though there may be higher demand in a certain city, I want to make sure that the middle of the country doesn't have terrible, terrible service, and especially if we're talking about something like fire stations. Now, coverage is related to this maximum distance. There, the idea is that there's a fixed radius, and a customer is called covered if its distance to the facility is less than the radius, and uncovered otherwise, and we're trying to do something like locate as few facilities as possible to make sure that everybody is covered within, let's say, 50 miles or 500 miles. And I'll talk about models like that a little bit more in a minute. And as I said, these objectives sometimes appear in the objective function, sometimes appear in the constraints. Slide 12. So obviously these models need some way of making sure that the model doesn't open too many facilities. If we're only optimizing the distance, let's say, or the coverage, then the natural solution is just open every possible facility, open a million facilities, and then we have great service. But of course that's not practical, so the model has to have some way of restricting the number of facilities, and there are two main ways to do that. One is to impose a fixed cost to open or operate each facility, and that cost can represent, let's say, the cost to build or lease the facility, as well as the cost to operate it, the fixed cost to operate it, like lights and heat and security and that sort of thing, that are relatively independent of the volume of the demand that's served by that facility. So the key thing here is that cost is independent of how much demand is served by the facility. If there are costs that are per unit costs that depend on the volume of the facility, those can usually get lumped in into the same model structures that I'll talk about in a second without changing anything too significantly. And then the second way to restrict the number of facilities is simply to impose a constraint that says the number of facilities has to be, let's say, no more than P, and P is some fixed number. So the company says, I'm willing to locate 6 facilities or 15 facilities, and we just optimize given that we have that constraint. So slide 13 now. Those different approaches that I laid out on the preceding few slides give rise to a lot of different combinations in terms of what we're optimizing and what the constraints are. And here I've listed 5 of the most famous classical problems and the objective function and constraints for each of them. There are many more, but these are probably the 5 most famous. So the p-median problem says that we're trying to minimize the demand-weighted distance or equivalently minimize the transportation cost. And we limit the number of facilities by a constraint that says we can locate at most P facilities, hence the name P median. The term median there refers to this demand-weighted distance issue. The uncapacitated fixed charge location problem, now that problem goes by several different names. Some people call it the facility location problem, FLP. Some people call it the fixed charge location problem. It has a lot of different names, but I call it the UFLP. And the problem there is to minimize, so we restrict the number of facilities using a fixed cost instead of a constraint. But other than that, we're trying to also minimize the demand weighted distance or the transportation cost. And there are constraints, but no explicit constraint on the number of facilities. The P center problem is similar to the P median problem in that we have a fixed number of facilities, but here the objective is to minimize the maximum distance, not to minimize the total distance. The set covering location problem and the maximum covering location problem both use this notion of coverage, and they're sort of inverses of one another. The first one is the objective is to cover all of the customers with the minimum possible number of facilities. And the second one, the objective is to cover as many customers as possible given a fixed number of facilities. So notice that in the first one, facilities are in the objective, in the second they're in the constraints, and vice versa for the coverage issue. Now in the second one, usually we're not trying to just maximize the number of customers covered, we're trying to maximize the sort of demand-weighted coverage so here a customer that has 10 times the demand of another customer would count 10 times as much in the objective function. Slide 14, I just want to mention briefly that many of these models also have a capacitated version. I'm assuming in everything that follows that there's no capacity on the facilities. Once I locate a facility, it can serve as much or as little demand as I want it to. But there are versions of these models that assume there's a fixed capacity. Usually that's just an input, it's fixed, but in some models it's also a decision variable. And in that case, there are usually two ways to approach it. One is that I have some set of discrete choices, like I could locate a 50,000 square foot or 100,000 square foot or 200,000 square foot facility, and those are my only three choices, and I have a different cost for each. Or sometimes capacity is just a continuous variable. I can choose whatever capacity I want, but the cost is just some function that's given. Cost is a function of the capacity. Okay, any questions so far about what I've talked about? Don't forget to unmute.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so now I'll talk about some of the IP formulations for some of the famous classical models. First, on slide 16, I'll lay out the notation. So we have sets, and I should mention that, you know, there are literally thousands of papers on facility location models, and there are different types of notational systems that are used. So you shouldn't assume that because this is what I'm laying out here that this is what you're going to see in every paper. There are some things that are more standard than others, expect to find different notation in different sources that you read. At any rate, the notation that I'll use is that we have a set I representing the customers, a set J representing the potential facility sites. I'm allowed to locate facilities among the locations in set J. We have three parameters. HI is the annual demand of customer I, and that can be measured however you want. By weight, can be volume, pallets, truckloads, whatever. CIJ is the cost to transport one unit, again, using the same units as the demand, pallets, truckloads, etc. Cost to transport one unit from facility J to customer I. And fixed cost, the FJ is the fixed cost to open a facility at site J. The decision variables there are two sets. XJ is 1 if facility J is open and 0 otherwise, and YIJ is 1 if facility J serves customer I and 0 otherwise. Okay, slide 17 gives the p-median formulation. So here the objective function is to minimize the demand-weighted distance, or equivalently the transportation cost. So we sum over the facilities and the customers. If I serve customer I from facility J, then YIJ is going to be 1. And in that case, I incur a cost of HI, CIJ. It's a per unit cost. CIJ is the distance cost, and I multiply that by the total demand. There are three main sets of constraints. The first one says that I have to serve every customer. So for each customer I, the sum over J of YIJ has to equal 1. The second set of constraints says I can't assign a customer to a facility that hasn't been opened. So if YIJ is 1, then XJ has to be 1 as well. And finally, I'm allowed to locate only P facilities, so the sum of all the XJs has to equal P. And the constraints are, the last set of constraints just says that the variables have to be binary. But actually, if the XJs are binary, then the YJs are going to be binary for sure, even if we relax them to be continuous. So you can replace the last constraints with Z 0 less than or equal to yij less than or equal to 1, but for simplicity, I'll just note those as binary. Next slide gives the UFLP formulation. So the UFLP is exactly the same as the p-median, except that instead of having constraints that restrict the number of facilities, I took out those constraints and I added a new term to the objective function, that sum j fj xj term, which just says for each facility j that I open, I have to pay the fixed cost fj. Other than that, it's the same as the p-median problem, and a lot of the algorithmic approaches for one also apply to the other.
Larry, here the yij can also be treated as continuous?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, right.
And then on slide 19, I'll give the formulation for the maximal covering problem. And this one has a somewhat different flavor, and we need a little more notation. So here, ZI is 1 if customer I is covered and 0 otherwise. Remember that a customer is covered if it's within a certain fixed radius from the facility it's assigned to. And we also have a set VI that represents the set of facilities that can cover customer I. In other words, the set of facilities that are within that radius of customer I. So if ZI is 1, then the customer is covered, and the objective function just maximizes the total demand-weighted coverage. We're allowed to locate P facilities, so we have that same constraint in the constraints. And then the other constraint says the definition of coverage. In particular, it says customer I is covered if there's some facility J in the set VI that covers I that's open. So as long as one of those XJs is open, then customer I is considered covered. And notice that there's no explicit assignment variable here. There's nothing that says customer I is assigned to facility J. If there's more than one open facility that covers the customer, that's not captured anywhere in this model. All I care about is the fact that there is at least one, and I don't really care which customer gets assigned to which facility in this model. I just care whether it's covered or not. Okay, so next I'll talk about a little bit about some of the algorithmic approaches. I'll give you a quick list of some of the approaches that have been used, and then I'll talk in more detail about one particular approach. So I'm on slide 21 now. First, it's worth noting that most facility location problems are NP-hard. There are relatively few exceptions to that. The exceptions that I know of mostly tend to be models in which the number of facilities is fixed and small, like I'm locating one or two facilities, and I'm locating on a network with a very special structure, like a tree network. And so there are these models that locate, let's say, one facility on a tree, and those models are polynomially solvable. But in general, the types of models that we care about for most practical implementations are NP-hard. On the other hand, in the scheme of NP-hard problems, many facility location problems, especially these classical ones, are relatively easy computationally. The main reason for that is that the LP relaxations are often extremely tight. So for the p-median and UFLP and the max covering problem, it's quite common to solve the LP relaxation and get an integer solution for free. And if what you get is not an integer solution, often the bound between the LP relaxation and the integer optimal is very small, a couple percent at most. Now, that's not always true, but it's often true, and that makes even branch and bound a very attractive method, you know, just straightforward branch and bound, an attractive method for the classical problems. Now, there is a rich methodology, a rich set of methodologies that have been applied to facility location problems. As I say in this last bullet, just about every type of algorithm that's ever been proposed for discrete optimization, at least as far as I can tell, has at some point been applied to facility location. And I think there are a couple reasons for that. One is that in the early days of facility location, let's say in the 60s, even straightforward implementations of branch and bound were not efficient and would not do a very good job of solving even the classical models. One of the main reasons for that is that just solving the LP relaxation could be very computationally challenging. And so other methodological approaches like Lagrangian relaxation were developed, and then these days, even though the classical models can be solved easily, they're often a kind of proving ground for new algorithms that are proposed. And moreover, a lot of the extensions that I'll talk about at the end of the talk are not solvable easily using off-the-shelf techniques. And so more customized, more high-tech algorithmic approaches have to be used. So slide 22, there are both heuristics and exact algorithms that have been proposed for facility location. In the category of heuristics, there are two main types of heuristics. One are construction heuristics, where the goal is to create a new solution from scratch, and the other are improvement heuristics, where the idea is to take a solution that has been created already and try to make it better. So the most common kind of construction heuristic is called the greedy add or greedy drop heuristic. The idea here is we start from no facilities open. We find the single facility that reduces that gives the lowest objective value, and we open it. Then we find the second facility that gives the lowest objective value, assuming the first facility stays open. It's never gonna change. So we open the second facility that helps the objective function the most. Then we keep those two fixed, and we open a third facility, and so on. And at some point, we'll discover that either we hit the constraint of P facilities, or we start opening new facilities, and they don't help the transportation cost that much, but they do hurt the fixed cost, and so it becomes not profitable to open a new facility, and then we just stop. That's the greedy add heuristic. And then the flip side is the greedy drop heuristic, where we open all the facilities, and we start closing facilities one by one, picking at each iteration the facility that helps the objective function the most to close it, and then we stop when closing a facility will hurt the objective function. So then the next two heuristics are improvement heuristics. The swap heuristic just says, okay, let's say I have a solution. What if I close one of the open facilities and open one of the closed facilities? And I look for pairwise swaps that will help the objective function, and I implement those. And neighborhood search is sort of similar. The idea there is that I look at the customers that are served by each facility. I try to figure out whether there's a better facility to serve those customers. If so, I move the facility, and then I try to, and then I look at the overall picture and see whether there are better assignments to make, and then I repeat. So those are both improvement heuristics, and there are, of course, others as well. Then there are literally hundreds of meta heuristics that have been applied to facility location problems. Every kind you can imagine, genetic algorithms, taboo search, all of these ant algorithms, bee algorithms, firefly algorithms, whatever kinds of other nature-inspired meta-heuristics you can think of have almost certainly been applied to facility location. And most of those meta-heuristics have both a construction phase and an improvement phase, so they kind of wrap both parts into there. And as I said, these heuristics are generally not necessary for the classical problems, which can be solved exactly pretty efficiently, but they are important for harder problems that have been developed more recently. Now, in the area of exact algorithms, again, most of the techniques you can think of for integer programming have been applied here. Simple branch and bound, cutting planes, decomposition methods like Bender's decomposition, Danzig-Wolf decomposition, and Lagrangian relaxation, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail. Lagrangian relaxation is one of the most common methods that's applied to facility location, and so that's why I'll go into more detail here. So I'll discuss that. I'm on slide 23 now. I'll discuss that in the context of the p-median problem. So here's the formulation again for the p-median problem, and I'm going to relax those so-called assignment constraints, the constraints that say that every customer has to be assigned to one facility. We could relax the second set of constraints, but this first set tends to give a tighter relaxation, so that's why we'll do that one. So on the next slide, I give the subproblem that arises. So for those of you not familiar with Lagrangian relaxation, the idea is get rid of a set of constraints so that the remaining constraints are somehow easier, and instead penalize in the objective function any violation of those constraints. So the new objective function in the first line is just the old objective function plus this new term, where for each I, because there was a constraint for each I have a lambda term, which is the Lagrangian multiplier. That's the penalty that I charge for violating the constraint. And then I just have the difference between the right-hand side and the left-hand side. So if the sum of the j's yij is not 1, then there's some then that multiplier appears in the objective. And if it is 1, then there's no multiplier there. Now, we can rearrange this objective function somewhat, because you'll notice that there are two different terms that are coefficients times yij, so I've grouped those now in the second line, and then the remaining term is just a constant, the sum of the lambda i's. So we assume at each iteration of the Lagrangian relaxation procedure that the lambda i's are fixed, and so that sum I lambda I is just a constant. And then the constraints that are left are yij less than or equal to xj, and sum of the xj's equals p. Now, this problem can actually be solved very easily. So if you'll go to the next slide, slide 25, That subproblem is separable by J. So flip back to 24 for a second. You'll notice that there is nothing in the objective function that ties more than one J together. And there are no constraints that have, let's say, a sum. I shouldn't quite say that. It's not exactly separable by J, but it's close in a way that I'll talk about. So go back to slide 25 now. So let's just suppose that we decided to open facility J. Then we can ignore the constraint on the first constraint that says yij less than or equal to xj, because now I'm assuming xj is 1. And for now, we can ignore the sum j xj equals p constraint. So all I'm left with is minimizing this coefficient, sum over I, coefficient times yij, and a single binary constraint. That's it. And that problem is very easy to solve. The solution is just I would set yij to 1 if the coefficient is negative, because it's a minimization problem, and I would set it to 0 otherwise. So now I can figure out how much would it help the objective function if I opened facility j. And the answer is the objective function would decrease by this, what I'm calling beta j, the benefit of opening facility j. And that's just given by the sum over all the I, hi, cij minus lambda I, in other words, the coefficient, unless the coefficient is positive, in which case I just count it as 0. So I sum up over all the negative coefficients. Those are the yijs I would set to 1. And that tells me which facilities I would like to open. In particular, I want to open the facilities with the p smallest beta j. Okay? Now, this does not give me a feasible solution. Almost certainly, some facilities in this solution, some customers will be assigned to more than one facility, some customers will be assigned to 0 facilities. This only gives me a lower bound on the optimal objective value, and that's not particular to facility location. That's a general property of Lagrangian relaxation as an algorithm. And so the next thing to do is to get an upper bound. Here we can do it very simply using a simple heuristic that I won't describe. And then the next step is to using some method like subgradient optimization or bundle methods, find some way of updating lambda, the Lagrange multipliers, and then repeat. And we do this iteratively. Maybe we solve a couple hundred or a couple thousand iterations like this and find that the upper and lower bounds are very, very close, which means that the upper bound is a near optimal solution. And if that's the case, I can just stop. And if I find that the upper and lower bounds are still far apart after performing a lot of iterations, then I can wrap this into some kind of branch and bound scheme so that I can close the gap using branch and bound. Okay? And as I said, this algorithm can apply almost identically with slight modifications to the UFLP and several other types of problems. Lagrangian relaxation gets applied with other kinds of structures to a lot of other facility location problems. So it's worth having a sense of how these things work. Any questions so far? Okay, so now I'll talk about some of the extensions that have been that have arisen from these classical models, and I'm on slide 27. So first I'll discuss just several other flavors of models, wrinkles on the classical models that have come up. So one is so-called obnoxious facilities, and these are facilities where, for one reason or another, instead of wanting them to be close, I want them to be far. So they might be dangerous facilities like hazardous waste sites. They might be facilities that customers don't want to be near, like landfills. But, of course, the issue is tricky with landfills because I don't want to be too far from my landfill. Otherwise, the garbage collection company is going to charge me a lot of money to ship it there, but of course I don't want to be too close to it either, so there's sort of a hybrid objective in that example. At any rate, obnoxious location problems try to maximize the distance from facilities to customers rather than minimizing. And by the way, I still have to assign the customer to the closest facility. So I don't get to maximize that distance by opening a whole bunch of facilities and then assigning everybody to the farthest facility that's open. That's cheating. So I'm only allowed to assign customers to the closest facility, but I want to do that in such a way as to maximize the distance. And there, usually, there's the opposite kind of constraint that says, for example, I have to open at least P facilities. Now, dispersion problems are similar, but there the issue is not the distance between facilities and customers, but between facilities and other facilities. So I don't want all the facilities clustered in a certain way. And one reason to do that is just to try to ensure some measure of equity, but of course we've already talked about a lot of other ways of doing that. Another application, though, is for something like nuclear waste sites where for chain reaction type reasons we don't want them to be located too close to each other. That example seems a little far-fetched to me, but I think that's the sort of thing that these get applied to. These aren't really commonly applied models, though. Next bullet is for competitive location, and this is a fairly rich body of literature. The idea here is that I have multiple players. So far we've only talked about models where there's a single player locating these facilities, and that player is going to capture all the demand from the customers that are served by those facilities. But in practice, Home Depot and Lowe's are going to open, anyway, that's an example in the U.S., but competing hardware stores, let's say, are going to open retail outlets in the same city, but they're only going to capture, let's say, half the demand from that city because there are two stores. And so in competitive location, the idea is that multiple players are locating the facilities in order to try to capture the most demand. And the demand could be captured a given customer might decide which store to patronize based on distance or based on some other preference measure. There are multi-objective models that try to account for the fact that facility location problems are often, especially in the public sector, have a lot of different stakeholders involved. So if you're locating schools or libraries, let's say, there are a lot of different parties that have opinions about where and how those should be located, and those opinions might be conflicting. And so multi-objective models tend to try to account for multiple objectives, and those use classical techniques for multi-objective programming. And then the next bullet is for hub location. The idea there is that in addition to having flows from the facilities to the customers, I also have flows among the facilities. So think about an airline hub where, let's say, United Air has a hub in Denver and in Chicago, and I have lots of traffic going out from the hubs to other places, but I also have a significant amount of traffic between the hubs, and therefore it's important to model the flows between the hubs. These are actually much, much harder problems computationally, mainly because the objective is quadratic. And then the next bullet is dynamic location. So often facilities are not located all at once. If I'm going to build 10 facilities, I may do it over time. And these models try to account for the fact that they'll be located over time. Maybe it's the case that I know that the demands or costs will change over time and I want to take advantage of that. Or maybe I just want to locate sort of the best facility first and the second best facility next and just sort of pick the right order. And then there are other dynamic location models where the facilities actually move over time. So one example is there's a famous paper where an ambulance is pre-positioned on a college campus and the pre-positioning changes over time. So during the day, it's going to be located near the classroom buildings. At night, it's going to be located near the dormitories and so on.
Larry, okay. Why is the hub location with the quadratic objective, just qualitatively, why is that the case?
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
Why is it a
why
quadratic?
Is it quadratic?
Objective?
Yeah, right.
Let me see if I remember. I think it's because in order to capture the flow between two facilities, I need to know that both XJ and XK are set to 1. Okay. Otherwise, there's no flow. It might not be in the objective, but in the constraints, rather.
So you multiply the binaries. Is that the quadratic?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I assume, I'm not an expert on quadratic programming, but I assume there are ways of linearizing it. But like most quadratic programming models, those have their own challenges.
Right. Thanks.
Okay, slide 28. So in the past, 20 years or so, there's been a lot of papers written about facility location under uncertainty. And roughly speaking, I'll say that those models fall into two categories, one of which is that they consider what I'll call demand-side uncertainty, where the randomness is in the demands or maybe in the costs. Whether cost is demand-side or supply-side is up to you, but from a modeling perspective, it's easiest to think of those as demand-side parameters, so I'll lump them in there. And then supply-side randomness is randomness in supply, and the most common example there is supply disruptions, which is a field that I've worked on a lot. So the idea there would be that facilities may be unavailable from time to time, and the question is, could we locate facilities in such a way that if a facility has a strike or a volcano, for example, then the other facilities are well positioned in order to kind of temporarily pick up the slack for that facility and serve the customers that facility was serving. There are various ways to approach to model the uncertainty. One is to use stochastic programming, which usually involves minimizing the expected cost. And there have also been a lot of papers on robust optimization approaches, where we're optimizing some other measure of randomness, not the expected cost, but something like the minimax cost, you know, minimizing the worst case cost or minimizing the worst case regret, and many of the other measures of robustness that have been proposed in various other areas, like portfolio optimization, have also been applied to facility location, like CVAR, conditional value at risk, have been applied to facility location as well. In terms of how these are modeled, sometimes the randomness itself is modeled using scenarios, like I have 5 or 10 or 100 or 1,000 different scenarios that just list the different possible states of the world, and maybe or maybe not, I have some probability for each. And then another way of modeling this is just that I have some interval. So I know that the demand is going to be between 100 and 250, and maybe I have a distribution, a probability distribution within that interval, or maybe I just know that it's going to be somewhere in that interval. Okay, slide 29. Relatively recently, there have been models that try to incorporate... So facility location is a strategic question. It's a question that you don't change often. And so there have been models that now incorporate tactical or operational costs into the strategic decisions. So, for example, a model that includes the cost of inventory or the cost of routing within the strategic model. And the purpose there is not so much to try to make multiple decisions at once, but just to account for the fact that the facility location decisions that I make now will not be able to change when I need to make other decisions later. And it tends to be true in these models that the facility location answers, the solutions, are different if I incorporate these tactical or operational questions into the model. So, for example, there's a model that came out in 2002 and a subsequent paper in 2003 that integrates location and inventory into the same model. And that model, the results of that model usually indicate that the number of facilities should be smaller once we incorporate inventory into the objective. So if I ignored inventory when I made the location decisions, I would effectively open too many facilities. And then when I went to optimize my inventory at those facilities, I would find that I have more facilities than I ought to have. This model has two additional terms in the objective function. So it basically looks like the UFLP, has exactly the same constraints, but it has two additional terms in the objective function. They're both concave. The first term captures the economies of scale that come from the cycle stock part of the inventory, and that's basically like an EOQ model, if you're familiar with that. And then the second term captures the so-called risk pooling effect or the safety stock cost. So this is a concave minimization problem. It's an integer programming problem. And yet it can actually be solved really efficiently. It's solved using Lagrangian relaxation, or there's another paper that solves it by column generation. And whereas in the UFLP, remember that subproblem that we solved by inspection, we were essentially doing that for each J, for each facility, in order... cardinality of I time, and I, remember, is the set of customers. In this case, I can solve the subproblem in order I log I time. So it's a little bit more computationally costly to solve the subproblem, but still very, very efficient. And I'm a big fan of this model, not only because my advisor was involved with it, but also because it just always astounds me that so much information about inventory can be captured so succinctly in the objective function, and also that even given these somewhat ugly nonlinearities, the model can be solved really efficiently. So if you're interested in that, I encourage you to check out that paper. Okay, slide 30. If you want to make facility location decisions, yes/no decisions or open/close decisions for multiple tiers or echelons, like you want to locate plants and warehouses, let's say, then you are entering the realm of network design problems or something very much like network design. Usually in the OR literature, we are given, in network design, we're given a set of nodes in the network, and we're trying to decide which arcs to open. But locating nodes, as we want to do here, is actually equivalent. We just create dummy nodes along the arcs, and that's easy. And there's a lot of literature on network design. The paper by Magnanti and Wong is a little bit old, but is a good starting point for that. So I just wanted to comment here that there is a relationship between facility location and network design. Now go to slide 31, you'll see I'm using the term network design here again, but I'm using it a little differently here. In practice, in the practitioner community, network design is used more broadly than it's used in the OR community. In OR, it's used to just mean the specific class of problems where we're given nodes and we want to choose which arcs to open. In the practitioner community, it's usually used to refer to any sort of problem where you want to figure out where should I have facilities and how should trucks go through those facilities, how should trucks be routed through the network, and other questions about flows through the network, let's say. And so in this section, I'll talk a little bit about some of the software that's commercially available for solving those problems. I should say I'm not an expert on this software. I don't tend to use it that much. Most of my experience with it comes from the fact that I worked for a company called Logic Tools when I was in graduate school, and I'm quite familiar with their software and a little bit with some of the competing software. But I'm going to talk about this from my own experience, but if you have experience with other software packages, you may disagree with me about some of the claims that I make, and I'd welcome your feedback on that. Slide 32 gives examples of a couple of the software packages. As I said, I worked for Logic Tools, which created LogicNet and a kind of expanded version called LogicNet Plus. Logic Tools was bought by iLog, which owns Cplex, and then recently Cplex was bought by IBM Consulting. So LogicNet is now part of IBM Consulting, and if you want it, you don't call Logic Tools anymore, you call IBM. There's another package that's somewhat similar, although in my experience a little less powerful, called Sales, and that's produced by a company called Insight. And most of the MRP-type software has ERP software has modules that do this kind of thing. SAP and Oracle have modules that do this sort of optimization as well. Slide 33 lists the standard capabilities that most of the software can do. So the main decisions that the software makes are, where should we locate facilities? How big should they be? What are the capabilities? For example, if there's multiple products, which facilities should be able to handle which products? How much volume should go through those facilities for each product. They make decisions on flows, the distribution lanes, sometimes yes-no decisions on the arcs. For example, if there's a fixed cost to open an arc, then the yes-no decision is critical, and sometimes just volumes. Sometimes they make versus buy decisions, so the software may be able to decide if I need to source a product, is it cheaper to make it in-house or to outsource it. And most of the software has the following features. They have some mechanism for importing data from spreadsheets or databases. They have some way of exporting the reports that the software generates, let's say maps or tables that list all the production levels and so on. They have some flashy graphical user interface. They have some sort of geographical information system that can map the solutions. And maybe the key part of it is the optimization solver. So either they're sending this model to something like Cplex, an off-the-shelf solver, or they have some customized algorithm that's solving the problem, or some combination of the two. Many of the software packages have a rating engine, so you don't have to tell it all the CIJs, the cost, the shipping costs. It can do that for you using standard databases of shipping costs. And usually they let you do some sort of what-if scenarios so you can solve the model multiple times with different assumptions. More recently, there have been some new developments, slide 34 now. I'm a little less familiar with these, but what I've seen mainly on these companies' websites is some new features like optimizing based on green considerations, environmentally friendly considerations. Sometimes that's trivial. I mean, when I reduce truck miles, I'm also reducing fuel, so the standard optimizations I used to do are now green optimizations because I'm reducing fuel. But sometimes there are other new wrinkles, like maybe the model is considering the ecological impact for producing at one factory versus another. Maybe one factory gets power from a coal-fired power plant and another gets power from a wind power plant, so on. And some of the software is beginning to incorporate objectives like that. To some extent, they have features for risk management, although I believe that's fairly limited. To some extent, they can handle tax issues, but usually only issues that are pretty simple. Sometimes they can handle seasonality and demand, and sometimes they can handle the trade-off between cost and service level in various ways. Most of the software, as far as I know, cannot handle the following things very well. They can't handle nonlinearities, for example, if there are quantity discounts. If those discounts are just in the form of breakpoints, then maybe they can handle it. But if there's some true nonlinearity, the software generally can't handle that. If there are open-closed decisions on the arcs, and there are lots of them, usually that's a problem. As far as I know, most of the software cannot really integrate that well with inventory models, even models that are implemented in other software that's produced by the same company. There may be ways of talking back and forth, but there's no way of integrating the inventory decisions into the facility location decisions or vice versa. And finally, although they can handle what-if scenarios, they can't optimize under uncertainty. In other words, they can't say, okay, here are multiple scenarios, find me the solution that minimizes the expected cost or the worst-case cost. And they can't really handle risk aversion in the sense of trying to have some balance between mean outcome and worst-case outcome. Okay, slide 35 just lists some other sources you might look to. There are some very good textbooks out there. And then the second section is just some review articles and book chapters that give you a broad overview but a little bit deeper into some of the topics. If you can't find some of these, you're welcome to send me an email and I can point you in the right direction or send you a copy. And I think that's it. I welcome any questions if you have them.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Larry. Very nice presentation.